Our second case for this morning is O'Neill against the City of Chicago. Ms. Kane.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Lisa Kane, and I'm representing the appellant, Brenda O'Neill. The issues before this Court are whether the plaintiff produced sufficient evidence from which taken as true, with all doubts resolved in her favor, with all evidence construed in light of the most favorable to her, and all reasonable inferences drawn in her favor, a rational trier of fact could reasonably find that the defendant retaliated against the plaintiff.
You don't have a rule against reading to us.
I'm sorry.
No, and believe me, we're really familiar with the summary judgment standard. So let me ask you this. In an effort to focus this case, I will tell you that upon reading your opening brief, I was hard-pressed to find a word about sex discrimination. I couldn't see anything that you were arguing that really presented an allegation that it was because of her sex that she was treated or transferred a lot or anything. I mean, it was all about retaliation, retaliation, retaliation. So my inclination is to think that sex discrimination is not really here anymore.
You know, truly, Your Honor, I think that the strongest argument for Ms. O'Neill is the retaliation count, given the fact that in her particular situation and her previous lawsuit, her lawsuit was brought up after, you know, being transferred 10 times and right before she was transferred into the vice squad under Lieutenant Kaczynski, her lawsuit was brought up again.
So all I just want to say then to clarify is we're all agreed then we're not going to focus on sex discrimination. That's gone. This case is about whether there was retaliation. And now on that point, what I want to get your comment on, I do not see in your brief an argument that this is a continuing violation, that this is something like a hostile environment case, which would allow one to say, well, no one transfer in and of itself was a violation, but when you take them all together, they're a violation. The district court did not agree with that way of looking at the case, and I don't see a challenge to that either. You're just talking a lot about context, but that's a different issue than trying to create. I mean, so much of your argument sounds like you're trying to say it's a continuing violation without saying that.
Well, I think that the real point, the district court relied on Heinrichter and stating that each of the subsequent transfers and reassignments, some of which were referenced by the defendant as details, were discrete acts. And I think given, you know, this court's opinion, in especially the Bryson case, what the plaintiff has tried to show, and I think it can't be disregarded, that when a police officer has been transferred to the numerosity of Sergeant O'Neill to her detriment, which ultimately has affected her promotional opportunities, I think the real point is in referencing Daniels versus Exis, which is that it's mainly foundational to show the support that there is a continuation of, you know, at least the transfers, which are ultimately precluding her from reaching her goal in the promotional opportunity, at least through a meritorious promotion, as she has already been successful in her written examination for the lieutenant's exam.
I understand that. But the problem is, you see, you're still doing it, really. You're trying to say that this, you know, putting to one side, I'm aware that the city argues that that you might be inflating the number a bit, but let's take it your way and say it's a lot of transfers. A continuous violation where one after the other means that she never has longevity in the job is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite another to look at the prior transfers to see if the intent in transferring her at that last transfer was to impede her promotional opportunities on the one hand, or whether it was really just to serve a valid city need. And I think you are stuck with only that second argument. You have not presented a challenge to the district court's decision that each of these was a discrete act.
No, I don't think...
You keep saying context, but the only thing it's contextual for is intent or motive.
That is strictly my point. I don't think that
but only
we're
the
making
one transfer,
the
that means we get to look at that one transfer and ask whether that's actually something that counts as an adverse employment action.
And that's precisely what I would like you to do, because that is, I mean, that is where we have the direct evidence of Lieutenant Kaczynski referring to the plaintiff as a troublemaker, calling her a militant sergeant, referring to her earlier lawsuit by stating that she had dated a gangbanger, which was a rumor.
But why does any of that matter if her transfer in June 2007 to the 3rd District simply puts her in another job that police lieutenants in the Chicago Police Force have, with the same pay, with the same kinds of responsibilities? Objectively speaking, why is the 3rd District an adverse employment action?
Well, I think
she may have a lot of bad blood between herself and Lieutenant Kaczynski, but why does that matter if there's no objective problem with being in the 3rd District?
Well, the objective problem is if you look at, and you'd have to actually consider some of this foundational, if you look at the settlement agreement entered into by the city and the plaintiff in 2003, and you look at the pattern of putting her in a detail, transferring back to narcotics, putting her in another detail, transferring back to narcotics. Ultimately, this is consistently, I mean, you can look at the number from 8 to 11 by the time you get to 2007, but all of this is affecting her ability in order to reach her goals, which is the promotion into the lieutenant. And what we do have is Cosgrove's testimony, Sergeant Cosgrove, who said this was extraordinary. He himself, in 18 years, and the plaintiff in this case is a 19-year employee of the city, has only been transferred once. The plaintiff, since her lawsuit, has been transferred, depending on if you take the defendant's argument or ours, 8 to 11 times in a matter of 3 years. And if you look at the timing of those transfers, it all affects her ability to take the test. It's days before, it's days after. It's not something that can be disregarded, especially when you consider that Bryson specifically does address in a retaliatory nature that if this were...
Bryson's a little different. I mean, why are you... In a sense, you're saying that the transfer to the 3rd District mm-hmm. is the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, why is this transfer the one that should be actionable?
Well, if for example, if I may, if you were to have filed a lawsuit, say, in 2003, after she has a settlement agreement with the city, and she came to court and she made the argument to you that, I don't like the transfer that I just received to the academy. And you, as the Seventh Circuit, would say, well, pursuant to Heinrider, we don't see an adverse action. I mean, you'd have to, because there it's a lateral transfer. There's no distinguishing characteristics. And here, what you and I think what needs to be really taken into consideration by the court is you have such an exhaustion by this woman. There is just every attempt to accommodate the needs of the city, and she is the one who is paying the price detrimentally, and that is the testimony that was elicited in discovery. We have supervisors saying that, and I think when you say what is the straw that broke the camel's back, I think the indices here and the inferences should be that she tried to be patient. It became so burdensome as to what she was being transferred back and forth, detail transfer, whatever, it's all synonymous, and it's semantics, that she suffered as a result and was not able to achieve the promotional opportunities that she so desired.
Is she still in the 3rd District?
Yes, she is. And I have to say
something. And does Kaczynski have any say-so over her?
No,
any
he does
authority
not.
Over her? No.
No, he does not, to my knowledge. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Masters?
May it please the Court. Sergeant O'Neill has obviously just narrowed her claims clearly to the Court to retaliation, so that's what we'll be addressing here today. While she made multiple arguments, we're going to focus on the dispositive facts that she has not shown She has suffered an adverse employment action, and she has not shown a causal nexus between any protected activity and her June 21, 2007 transfer. And we're going to stand on our briefs for the remaining arguments. The thrust of Sergeant O'Neill's claim is that her June 21, 2007 transfer to the 3rd District adversely impacted her prospects for merit promotion to lieutenant. In that regard, I want to make clear that she has not made the argument, although she has sort of taken the gambit here, I think, that that promotion was the straw that broke the camel's back. As we pointed out in our brief, she actually doesn't say that. That type of argument would be if she wanted to say something like, 4 promotions are fine, but the 5th one pushes me over the edge and no one's going to consider me for promotion. What instead she's saying is that a promotion affects my personal relationship with somebody who's got to get to know me in order to make a recommendation for me to be promoted to lieutenant. And that's not a type of cognizable claim in this court because it is entirely speculative. There's no evidence that any commander has to make any recommendations for any sergeants to merit promotion. She could work for someone who just isn't going to recommend anybody, no matter what. So she can't have the claim.
Taking the evidence in the light most favorable to her, isn't there some evidence that that de facto is the way the merit promotions work, that you kind of get a sponsor, and isn't that whatever his name was, Captain Wilberg or somebody, testifies to?
Yes, and we don't disagree that you do have to get to know somebody, presumably, for somebody to recommend you. But our point is that there's no that commanders aren't required to make recommendations. So she could work somewhere for 10 years and be working for somebody who is never going to recommend anybody for merit promotion for whatever reasons. And I think we all know from personal experience in the workplace that there are people who are supervisors who advocate for the advancement of the people who work for them, and then there are the people who do nothing to advocate for the people who work for them. And
as a matter of fact, if you get transferred, you might find somebody who's better, more inclined to recommend people than one you've got.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely correct. Or she could be in a situation where, for instance, she stays with Commander Weiberg in narcotics, and then he retires. So she's going to have a new commander. So it's a type of claim that... That type of injury she's claiming, the adversity that she's complaining, is about the ability to establish a personal relationship, and that's not a cognizable claim. It's just not an adversity because it's just entirely too subjective to be recognized by the court. Counsel also just a moment ago, there were some questions about affecting her test performance, but that's not before the court either. In fact, the record doesn't even contain a claim that somehow she performed worse on the test, and therefore she's not eligible for promotion off the list.
Instead, what I wanted to explore with you for a minute is how the prior sequence of transfers and details, some were one, some were the other, which the district court says are available to be used as context, even though they're not standalone incidents for which she would be entitled to recover. How you think they do fit in? Because we certainly have cases in which we've said you can look at prior actions to understand exactly what's going on in the present. And yet, of course, on the other hand, if she's not making a continuing violation argument, which is I still think she isn't making, but I don't know. It's not like a hostile work environment claim where somebody says insulting things day in and day out, and no one of them is alone enough, but when you take them all together, they're actionable.
Well, we would make a couple points about that. First of all, to be clear, we believe she's conceded she's not making a continuing violation argument. But the second thing we would do is, I know counsel referred to Bryson, but Stevens and Jackson, which we cite in our brief, are much more recent cases, which specifically say that you can't look at past actions in a retaliation claim and past promotion decisions because they're each discrete and done for their own reasons, and the court would have to conduct a mini trial as to each of them. And we think that this case is really a terrific example as to why that rule is a good one. And when you look at the way plaintiff begins her whole process of pointing to retaliatory promotions by looking at the one where she is actually moved to the academy to stay with Commander Weiberg, who wants her to work with him because He calls her one of the members of her team and a go-to person. Now, it would certainly be our position that under no stretch of the imagination could that be considered retaliatory. And even under her theory that you need to have a long-term relationship with somebody, that gives her a continuing relationship with somebody. So you can't look at prior promotion decisions, or I'm sorry, job assignments, in a continuing violation claim. I think the most you could do is sort of look at them and to give the example I gave when I first started up here, to say you're in a situation where maybe four moves in a certain amount of time is fine, but the fifth one makes you start to look like damaged goods. You could bring in those four other actions to show they happened. You wouldn't be talking about why they happened, but you would certainly be talking to establish as foundation that they occurred. And I think that that would be a proper context. But again, not to be looking at motive. The other point we would make is that there's no evidence in this case, even under plaintiff's own theory of what she's really promoting in her brief, that Lieutenant Kaczynski's actions are related to retaliatory intent. Under her own version, throughout her opening brief and her reply brief, she repeatedly tees off what happens to her, the June 21st, 2007 transfer, off the May 1st letter she writes to Lieutenant Kaczynski's boss, Commander O'Donnell, in which she basically complains that Lieutenant Kaczynski is a poor manager who tolerates disgruntled employees. Now, given that that is her version of events, and we commend that letter to the court, that letter says nothing about, it does not contain a complaint from her about retaliation, and I guess we can take gender off the table as well. She's not complaining that he has done anything to retaliate against her. He's saying that he tolerates disgruntled employees and he's a bad manager. So whatever else one might say, given that that is what she tees off her title, her complaint off of, that's not Title VII retaliation. That's not cognizable as a protected activity under Title VII.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about that for a second, because she could be complaining that she's retaliating, that she's being retaliated against because of the original 2002 lawsuit. Or she could be claiming that she's being retaliated against because she complains about Lieutenant Kaczynski in that letter. And I understand you to be saying that you don't think that letter is protected activity?
Absolutely. That's absolutely our position. And obviously the court can read the letter. But she's complaining about disgruntled employees being on her team, and she seeks to have them removed from her team. That's not Title VII protected activity. Now, to the extent that she is relying upon her 2002 Title VII lawsuit, she really makes scant attempts to link what happens to her in June 21st, 2007, that transfer, to her 2002 Title VII lawsuit. She's not adduced evidence that Lieutenant Kaczynski even knew that that lawsuit was about Title VII, was about race, was about gender. But even
what
if
about the gangbanger comment?
Right, but even he says it was a lawsuit about her being removed from position for being a gangbanger, dating a gangbanger. That's still, in our view, not enough to establish that he knows she's brought suit over race and gender. But even if the court were to presume that, the problem is that it still doesn't mean that what he is doing in terms of ultimately asking that she be removed from the assignment with him, that he's doing it out of retaliatory animus, because again, her own claim is that he does that after she writes the May 1st letter complaining about the disgruntled people on her team. So we just believe that that nexus is not there. She's not entitled to that inference, even under her own theory that she has pursued in this court. This court has repeatedly said it doesn't sit as a super personnel board, and we would ask that it not accept Sergeant O'Neill's invitation to do so. For the reasons set forth in our briefing here today, we ask that the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Further, Ms. Kane?
Thank you. I just have a couple of points I'd like to make. With regard to counsel's most recent statement that Sergeant O'Neill had the option of always staying under Officer Weiberg in order to receive the promotional opportunity, that is just not accurate. It is not the evidence in this case. As a matter of fact, as soon as she receives the settlement agreement in 2003, she is transferred 3 months later to the academy. Then she is transferred back for a week to narcotics. Then she's transferred to Unit 142, which is not under Weiberg. It all should be noted that Weiberg retired in 2005. With regard to the point that there is no nexus between the discrimination in the earlier lawsuit and the retaliation, the fact of the matter is there is evidence in this record that Kaczynski learned of her lawsuit right before she entered into his unit and had a conversation with Grau, who had also filed a lawsuit against the city of Chicago, in which he identified the earlier lawsuit and began to disparage her. Now, with regard to the original complaint...
Is it Grau or this guy Dunn?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Dunn. I apologize. It is Dunn. But Grau does testify that if you do not have a familiarity with the officer, it's a little bit difficult to then recommend them for a promotional opportunity. And Weiberg also testified with the nature of which they were transferring her, it was almost impossible. And if you look at the record, and it's broken out exactly the dates and times that she was transferred, she never had a job longer than 6 to 9 months in any one place. And, you know, with the issue of, you know, why is this the actual impetus for this lawsuit after all these transfers? And the truth of the matter is she was trying to work within the system, and clearly unsuccessfully, and wished to receive the meritorious promotion of which she was entitled. And I thank you so much for your attention and consideration today, and I respectfully request that you reverse the district court's decision, and I hope you have a really nice day. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.